There is a lot of diversity of students at WT. I'm really impressed from geographically where they come from, their ethnicity, the age of students, and especially teaching online, seeing the different scope of students.
You're listening to Buff Speak, the official podcast of the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University. I am Dr. Nick Gerlich, your host, as we meet up with the thought leaders making an impact today.
The typical university professor is someone who has spent their whole life in school, often until the age of 30. They know nothing but the seasons of education, the year partitioned into semesters and summer terms, with abundant time off in between. Each one of those terms is finite, with clearly defined start and ending dates. The profs know it, their students know it. They live and function as one. But it's a lot more rare to find someone teaching who has industry experience, who hasn't toiled in the trenches of academe their whole life, who knows that business is always on and seldom, if ever, takes a time out. There is no start or finish. It's just one day following another. Recently, the College of Business was able to attract a retired executive from the local power company to join us as a part-time instructor. He brings with him a wealth of practical knowledge and experience, the kind that often cannot be found in a textbook. My guest today is Mr. David Hudson, former president of Southwestern Public Service, a division of Xcel Energy. David, welcome to the podcast and welcome to our faculty. I kind of wish I were a student again and able to listen to you bring business concepts to life in the classroom.
Well, good. Thanks for having me. And I really have always respected WT and all the offerings that it has to our region. And after I retired, I thought, what's next in my chapters? And I thought, you know, I think sort of passing it on to future generations was an ambition that I have.
Before we dive into your classroom, tell us your story, where you started and how you got here.
Sure. Yeah, I grew up in Lubbock. And actually, my parents were both teachers. My father was a professor at Texas Tech in animal science and agriculture. And many times I'd go out to the tech farm with him and see him dealing with livestock and animal production. And I just thought, you know, that's not in it for me. I'm more mechanically inclined. And so when attending high school, I was taking drafting for a couple of years. And I had mentioned to my instructor, I was interested in being an architect. And he said, no, you don't want to be an architect. You should be an engineer. And it wasn't long after that, I became acquainted with the industrial engineering department at Texas Tech. And I thought, that's what I should do. And so I dove into that, and I do not regret it today.
And so you chose engineering over architecture and of course, your dad's animal science and everything. Did you just have some innate skills there that, you know, you're kind of born with?
Well, I think I always enjoyed math and science. I was more inclined in that direction. And so I enjoyed, learning new things, new concepts, but really how do things work?
And when did you graduate?
I graduated in 1983 from Texas Tech.
Okay. And then you went on the job market.
That's right. You know, at that time, I was fortunate enough, I was working for Texas Instruments in Lubbock, where we had the consumer products group and making calculators, speak and spell, speak and math, if you can remember all the way back to the 1980s on those products, the TI home computer. And saw how fast that ramped up. We had manufacturing lines going in Lubbock. And then they just totally missed the market to Commodore and other people. And TI decided to exit a lot of those consumer products. And they're no longer, well, I guess they still have calculators that they make overseas nowadays. But then I saw how fast they can disembark a business. And so I thought, you know, I'd look for something a little bit more stable. And I was familiar with Southwestern Public Service Company and Xcel Energy, and actually had toured their power plant just outside of Lubbock.
So which was it? Did you choose SPS or did they choose you? Did you have your eyes on them with career potential before you started your job search?
Well, actually, they were looking for an industrial engineer and to do cost of service and rate design work. And a cost of service is where you basically understand how costs are caused, and then you allocate it to the customers and the customer classes that cause the cost. And usually on demand and energy, which is, electrical engineering, which I had had those classes. And so I had heard that they were looking for an industrial engineer. At the same time, they were aware through other people they had interviewed about me. And of course, being from Lubbock and knowing the region and knowing a great reputation that they had, I was very interested in it. And so I applied and was hired in January of 84. And moved to Amarillo, and I've basically been here ever since.
So aside from that short stint with TI and their failed attempt to crack the consumer market, you've spent your whole career pretty much at one place. That's a rarity these days. I just don't see that. I mean, why did you choose to stay with one company the rest of your professional life when so many other people around us, well, especially those younger than us, move around very often?
Well, yeah, you're right. People do move around, especially more now. They're more portable. And actually, when I was in management at Xcel Energy, we had to take that into account that employees are going to be more and more portable and moving around. When I was very blessed that I caught on quickly to concepts. And after going to work at SPS in Amarillo, I started working on my MBA at WT and driving down here for night classes in the mid-80s and graduated in 1990. So I could understand the business elements of it. So that gave me the opportunity to progress rather quickly into management and working in the regulatory environment, which is very litigious, learning the legal administrative process, and just understanding the business and moving up quickly. And just basically I could see a career path for myself. And eventually, after being in running regulatory for probably 25 years, I got to move into other areas with the ambition to continue to grow my professional career and seeing a path to being the leader of Southwestern Public Service at Xcel Energy.
And when did you become president?
In 2014.
And you held that position until
the middle of 22. So
when you retired.
Yeah, 8.5 years, which is pretty long for a president. I was very blessed. And I saw a lot of change through those 38 years.
I'll bet you did. And how large is SPS's footprint? And obviously, what was the range of your leadership, basically?
Yeah, well, so SPS, it's still the same legal entity it always has been. It's just now wholly owned by Xcel Energy and goes by the brand name of Xcel Energy. But SPS operates all the way from Carlsbad Cavern, south of Carlsbad, New Mexico, all the way up through the Pecos Valley, the bottom of the Panhandle, up through the top of the Panhandle, all the way to Perryton and Follett is the very northeast corner. And so serves about 93 towns and cities, significant power production activities going on, transmission, and then distribution and sale of electricity.
That's a lot of people and certainly a lot of land that you've got covered. Your line of business is very different from most others in that it is a regulated monopoly. And, people only complain about their bills and when the lights go out, basically. But otherwise, they just expect you to be there and they can flip any switch or hit a power button on a remote and they expect everything to be okay. Because it's like turning the spigot on your outdoor tap, you expect water to come out, right? And you flip a switch, you expect there to be electricity. But when there isn't, you get yelled at, right? There's got to be a problem here. What kinds of unique challenges and stresses did you face with this kind of business reality?
Well, electricity is a very unique electro phenomenon. where it moves at the speed of light. So things can go wrong at the speed of light. And we have very many protective devices to protect people and property from damage because of the extreme power that's out there on the system. And so usually when the power goes out, it's because something is sensed, something abnormal, and it shuts it down immediately. So it's got to protect life of the public and then our employees and then just equipment and people's, you know, homes and businesses. But I would say we dealt with many things. Let me just think about, you know, one of them was when they had significant rainfall up in Wyoming, and it washed out the railroad tracks. We were not able, and many utilities across the country were not able to get coal from Wyoming. So we had to start, you know, we had to have contingency plans. Now we actually store coal at the power plants, but we were worried. And actually some of the power plants in our sister companies up in Minnesota started running out of coal. That was a big issue. I think our biggest problem would be severe weather events. The worst being probably an ice storm. I can remember that taking down probably every pole up in the Northeast Panhandle. And then just finding the resources to get everything back put together as fast as possible. Tornadoes, you dealt with tornadoes multiple times a year. And so, you know, you do a lot of contingency planning. What if this happens? What's the playbook for this? And so we literally have playbooks to deal with different types of serious events.
Parts of the U.S. have experienced Mother Nature's fury the last few weeks with intense hurricanes and related weather events. We've never really had anything quite that severe here in Amarillo Canyon. We've had some tornadoes and stuff, but this was widespread. You know, my brother lives in Tampa, and they didn't have any damage to their house. He's just far enough inland to get out of the danger zone in that regard, but he didn't have power for 5 days. And if it weren't for the fact that he has a generator, he would have lost all the food in his freezer and refrigerator, and they had enough juice to keep that going and a few fans because, you know, it's still summer down there and it's really, really hot inside. I can't imagine going 5 days without power. How would you have managed such an extreme situation?
Yeah, of course, we never faced something like a hurricane, but we had, I think, was it in 2024 or 2025? I can't remember the bomb cyclone where we had 80-mile-an-hour winds, and it was literally all the way from Carlsbad to the top of the Texas Panhandle. So we lost a lot of infrastructure. But a lot of the utilities belong to coordination groups where they coordinate resources in an emergency like this. So even Xcel was sending linemen down to Florida a couple of weeks ago, and they have to work with their vendors on getting new poles, new wire, new transformers, because everything gets destroyed. And so they've worked out these contingencies. They just know they need the resources. So they bring them literally to the doorstep of the storm, wait for the storm to pass, and then bring them in.
They just hope they weren't staying at the Tropicana, the stadium where they were going to have the big staging area for all these out-of-town power workers. And then what, the roof got ripped off the stadium.
Yeah.
They had to find another home for them while they're down there.
You know, we would have to think of logistics like when we had the Northeastern Panhandle ice storm, we'd have to look at logistics of where's everybody going to stay? Because we brought in resources from Tennessee, contractors, other utility people. Where do they all stay? How do you feed them? So literally it's a huge planning and management issue.
David, what are some other big challenges on the job?
Well, safety is one of the biggest challenges, is just making sure everybody stays committed to the core value of safety. Whether it's the simple exercise of going downstairs and using the 3 points of contact, you know, a handrail and your 2 feet. You know, I'd go to a power plant and see people sliding down the rails of the stairs, you know, which is a safety violation. Driving is another one. You know, people don't realize that driving is one of the biggest hazards there is out there because it's easy to become distracted nowadays. I think Probably some of the biggest challenges I faced were dealing with regulatory agencies, very adverse customer groups. People don't realize that, but Xcel Energy, SPS, its largest customers buy more electricity in a year than all the residential combined. So one oil company buys more electricity in a year. So they have a very vested interest to intervene and basically stop what you're doing. And so that causes a business friction. And so just the whole business concept of earning your profit and Xcel Energy, you know, making sure that it's being managed properly so that they earn a fair and reasonable rate of return.
And by virtue of electricity being a regulated monopoly, I'm sure it's not hard for some people to think that, well, the prices can just get out of hand because they can do whatever they want. And they probably don't realize that all rate increases have to go through a regulatory commission. They got to be approved, right?
That's right. I mean, we cannot change a price, a practice, or procedure for a customer. You know, it's all in detailed writing. We can't change any of that. It's our tariff, basically, without getting regulatory approvals. In Texas, actually, each city has a regional jurisdiction. So we would have to go to like 80 towns and cities and then go to the PUC in Austin, the Public Utility Commission. And I spent a lot of time providing expert testimony, being cross-examined by these adversaries that are wanting to keep their bills as low as possible, and going through cross-examination. So, you know, that was a huge challenge in working through that.
And how is the price of electricity here in Amarillo and Canyon compared to other parts of the country or even just downstate?
You know, SPS has always been recognized as a very low-cost producer. And, of course, rates are based on cost with a reasonable rate of return reflected in there. And a lot of times in a case, you would argue about what is the reasonable return on equity in a case. But basically, our prices have been very favorable. Now, recently, SPS has been growing very, very fast because we serve part of the Permian Basin. And that, along with new data centers coming online, the demand for power is going way up. And of course, when your rates are based on your historical cost depreciated, that's at a low value. But now we're adding new costs that are coming in new. And so our average is going up quicker than it has in the past.
While we typically get few ice storms every winter, and they certainly wreak a lot of havoc on power lines, it's definitely the wind that keeps everyone wondering if they're going to have power tonight out here. How do you and SPS prepare for those very predictable spring days when we have winds howling over 60 miles an hour?
You know, we actually have a meteorology group, and pretty sophisticated. It's actually located in the Denver offices. And what they do is they can predict, they can see when the low pressure systems are forming out west and moving towards us. That's where you get the really strong southwest winds. And then after those low pressures pass over you and go east, then that's when the cold fronts come down because it's a low pressure moves counterclockwise. So we could predict and we could know where it's going to be. And you could tell how widespread it's going to be. We could even tell where we thought there were going to be thunderstorms the next day. And it's so precise now that they can forecast the weather for each specific wind farm. They know, and not only do they know at what elevations, because the turbines are actually, the newer ones are taller. So they can understand the wind currents at different elevations. And so we could forecast, and if we knew if we were going to have a strong thunderstorm potential or tornado potential, we could start moving linemen and trucks and poles a day ahead of time so that we could be prepared in case there was going to be a major event.
It's kind of like the snowplows going out and brining the road the night before.
Yeah.
Because they heard it's probably going to snow or ice the next day.
That's right.
Yeah, that makes good sense.
Yeah.
And, well, then there's the wildfires that can happen when there's a down power line. How do you even begin to predict where that might happen? I mean, that was a big deal a year ago out here. We had the biggest fire in the whole country.
That's right. I think one of the records for the state of Texas. You know, we would have wildfires. I mean, they're, you know, it gets so dry in the spring and the wind is so intense. But basically, what we have practices of inspecting, patrolling lines, looking for something that may look loose, looking at poles, inspecting poles, making sure they're not rotting out at the ground. So there's different practices and procedures you can do. And then also being able to react as quickly as you can.
How and where do you generate power in this area? I mean, these are, again, these are the things we really don't pay attention to here as just normal consumers. We just expect the lights to go on. We have no idea where it's coming from. Where are your power generating plants out in the panhandle?
Okay. Yeah, for the whole SPS system, we have power plants in Amarillo. There's a coal plant just north of town. And then there's a natural gas plant just south of that. It's older. Now, the coal plant's actually being converted to natural gas by the end of this year because of the EPA requirements to reduce sulfur dioxide. And we determined it's cheaper to convert it to natural gas than put in $600 million of new scrubbers on a coal plant that's 40 years old. It just doesn't make sense. And so we decided to convert it to natural gas. It's just a way to continue to use that low-cost resource. Now, there's also another large coal plant near Muleshoe. And they're all connected to each other through the transmission network. That power plant has issues as it uses groundwater for the steam cycle, where, you know, you have to cool the steam back to a liquid before you can pump it back to the top of the boiler. And the plant here in Amarillo uses municipal wastewater for that. So we reuse municipal wastewater. But the plant near Muleshoe Tulk Station is running out of groundwater, and it's projected to shut down in 2028. So it's not very far off. So right now, Xcel Energy SPS has actually got a request for proposals for new generation resources in the Panhandle area. Now, SPS also has gas plant near Lubbock and other gas plants around Hobbs, New Mexico. So they're spread out across the system.
Well, it's also very clear that renewables are a big part of the current energy scene and that things have changed considerably in recent decades. I seldom see coal trains in the area these days. I mean, that's a trend that has to hurt the railroad, not to mention the state of Wyoming where the coal was mined. We're going to come back to this topic a little bit later in the show, but what are your initial thoughts on this big shift?
Well, it's sort of like taking one of your baskets away when you're saving your eggs. You know, you sort of distribute your eggs around to different baskets for risk and diversity purposes. We're now losing a major resource with coal. You know, coal, like I said, you can store the energy at the power plant in a coal pile. And that has a lot of benefits to it. Whereas natural gas, you can get it out of the pipeline. But during Winter Storm Uri a few years ago, we were very concerned because the gas production in the Permian started to freeze up. When the natural gas comes out of the ground, it has liquids in it, including water, and was hitting the cold pipes and freezing. So they were not able to process as much natural gas and inject it. And so the pipeline started to go low on pressure. And so they were cutting off people from natural gas. And we were really concerned we were going to lose that. But we have been using more and more wind energy. You know, I think right now SPS has probably 35% of its annual energy comes from wind resources. 41% natural gas. So, I mean, wind is almost catching up with the top producer of electricity in our region. Coal is down to 22%, and by 2028, it's going to be gone. It'll be off the system. Solar, we have, you know, just about 2% of solar. There's a large solar farm by Roswell that's connected to the grid.
So basically, in a few more years, that meme I've seen on social media with a Coltrane coming to fuel the generating plants to be able to charge your Tesla. That won't be true around here anymore, will it?
No, it will not be, and it's largely being phased out across the country. There's so much pressure from the federal government and the EPA because coal produces twice as much CO2 per megawatt hour than natural gas. So clearly going to natural gas, and ironically, with all the oil production that's now going on in the Permian, natural gas has almost become a waste product of the oil industry. That's why natural gas prices have come down so much, is they have to capture it. They can't vent it. And so they've got to capture it and process it and put it into the pipelines.
Now, there's a lot of talk about the grid and, you know, various grids around the country. Explain to us how and why Amarillo was able to dodge that bullet back in February of 21 when the rest of the state that was faced with a formidable cold wave experienced prolonged power outages. And it was on, you know, national news. We saw all these people freezing in Austin, and it actually wound up killing a lot of the trees down there too. But I recall my power going out for, not more than 30 minutes. What's different about Amarillo?
Well, the big difference is in the panhandle, it does get down below 0 degrees. So our power plants, or XL Energy, SPS's power plants, are cold weather protected. They basically have an outer shell around the boiler. If you look at them, you'll see the buildings have a metal. You go downstate and they have what's called open air boilers, where you can just literally look through the steel lattice and you'll just see the boiler in the buildings. What happened is down south, when it got that cold, the pneumatics on those power plants started to freeze up and they lost. Whenever you lose control of a boiler, you got to shut it down because it becomes extremely hazardous. Whereas our power plants were weather protected. Now we have one open air boiler in Hobbs, and that one actually did freeze up. But otherwise, we were able to continue to produce. And when you had your 30-minute outage, it wasn't actually because of an issue we had at SPS. It was because the utilities in Oklahoma had open air boilers and they were freezing up and they were losing them. And so the power pool that we're in, the Southwest Power Pool, was making ratable curtailments across all the utilities that are part of the pool. That's just part of the reliability equation. And so we had to cut for 30 minutes and actually we rotated it. You know, we brought you back and cut somebody else off, but we were just having to curtail to help the Oklahoma utility out.
It was just a minor inconvenience. It was no big deal. But my hunch is that, we were the envy of the state at that time, in spite of the fact that downstate media routinely make fun of Amarillo for being the coldest part of the state. We kind of had the last word on that, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. We favored very well. And it's just because of we at 3,700 feet already, we have to cold weather protect our equipment. We're used to getting below 0 degrees, whereas they're not downstate. And I think the thing that disturbed me the most was how the natural gas froze up. And the natural gas industry sort of skated through politically through this whole process. They basically have not had to change much.
When we come back, we'll take a look at David's classes and what his lucky students are experiencing that others aren't.
The MBA is the most popular graduate degree in the United States, and with good reason. It leads to better jobs, promotions, and salary increases. At the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University, our MBA program is entirely online for when you're ready to make that move. With as few as 31 credit hours and specializations offered in 5 areas, you can fast-track your career in as little as 18 months. Whether you're looking for a promotion or initial job placement, you'll stand head and shoulders above the competition. And because we've been teaching online since 1997, we're not the new kids on the block. Trust your education and career to dedicated faculty who are not only experts in their fields, but also old pros in the online arena. Our consistently high rankings say it all. A GMAT waiver is available. We're AA CSB accredited and among the most elite of business schools around the world. Reach for the stars and do it with a WT MBA in hand. For more information, find us at wtamu.edu/COB or call 806-651-2500. From the Texas Panhandle to the world, we're here to help you reach those stars.
I remember all too well my first time in the classroom, having been told 2 days before starting my PhD program that I would be teaching a section of Principles of Marketing. For about the first 2 months, I stood in a pool of sweat as I tried to educate students only 3 years younger than me. I hope they learned something, but I still have some nagging doubts. David, what's it been like for you to step into the classroom, and were you nervous?
I would say I was just a little nervous. You know, I've presented to big groups before, like I said before, testified on the witness stand many times. And basically, if you know your subject, you're going to be just fine. And that's the way I felt. You know, just getting prepared, though, getting ready for it, not knowing exactly what to expect in the classroom.
Well, and I suppose being generationally separated from your students, actually like 2 generations separated from them, that made a very different dynamic than to some young guy walking in the room who looked a lot like everybody else in the room, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, you step back and think about it. Most of the kids that are in classes now weren't even born when 9/11 occurred, you know, and so you start talking about these events and then you think, oh my gosh, they weren't even around back then. And they're already used to the iPhone. That's all they've really experienced.
That is a crazy thought. I mean, to ponder that 9/11 is now outside the collective memory of most college students alive, and much less, you know, all the cool music from the 70s, you know, when we talk about the Eagles or Fleetwood Mac, they have no idea who we're talking about, right?
that's right. Yeah. I remember my daughter saying, you got to listen to this song, Dad. It's Hotel California. She goes, it's a really cool song. I said, that was around when I was in high school.
Tell us about the classes you're teaching for the College of Business.
Okay, I'm teaching 2 sections of Principles of Management, which is the introduction to business management. And so I'm teaching 1 in the classroom. I wanted to do that and experience that. And then I'm teaching 1 asynchronously online.
And how is it different being in front of the class now, whether it's face-to-face or online, instead of in front of all your employees? I mean, I can see similarities in that. You have power in both positions. You're the professor or you're the president, but it's a little bit different. I mean, they're not working for you. You can't fire them. You can't fire a student, right?
Not easily. Of course, you can't fire employees that easily either sometimes. But usually the employees had already a lot of knowledge of the business, whereas I had to really recalibrate myself when walking in, realizing these students barely even know what business is. I mean, they're basically, a lot of them are transitioning from Amarillo College or community college. Some of them have come in literally out of high school because they've had so many dual credits, and they're coming right into your class. So they don't really understand business at all. So I'm really having to basically go down to the ground level and explain business to them.
You said you're doing both on campus and online. Do you find one format more challenging than the other? And if so, why?
You know, actually, I find in the classroom to be more challenging. I'm really trying to get the students to participate more and get involved in the discussions. Right now, I think that's probably been one of my disappointments, is the student engagement has not been as high as I would expect it to be. You know, I think I want to work harder on that. I give them examples, but, you know, I'm still not sure they can relate yet. And I think that's the biggest aspect, because I can remember when I was in high school, even when I was in college, it's hard to relate to what you're learning to what the real world is like.
Well, and it's not you. This happens to me, too, in my classes. I can come in and talk and try to get a conversation going, and I've got 30 blank looks.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I notice. And, you know, they're looking at maybe their tablet or their computer. And like I was talking to another instructor, you know, some of them are taking notes. That's how they take notes. Other people are just sitting there not taking any note. And you're like, goodness gracious, this is a great resource you're wasting.
And I've taught online for many, many years now. Sometimes I feel like I can be more effective in the online arena because at least I can command their attention for a few minutes every day while they're at home or wherever it is they're logging in. Whereas in the classroom, I often feel like I'm just competing with too many other interests, whether it's they're looking at Pinterest on their tablet or whatever they're doing.
Yeah. A big subject in this principles of management is active listening. You know, many times I would be in meetings, even at the senior executive level, because I was on the executive committee for the corporation, and you would find people tuned out. They would be looking at their phones or not paying attention, and somebody would call on them and they would be embarrassed by it. I said, you got to be an active listener.
So how are university classes, and for that matter, the students, different from when you were at Tech 40 years ago?
Yeah, 40 years ago.
Jeez.
Yeah. You know, like I started off with it, they're very diverse. We see diversity and ethnicity and culture that's changed a lot. The age, you know, I've seen that. I've seen some students that literally drive from Littlefield to classes here twice a week. And, you know, I respected that. Then on my online class, I think I have some students from the state of Washington. So just understanding and knowing that probably online students are probably a little bit older, a little bit more mature. I noticed they are able to get their assignments done and turned in. Whereas the class ones are probably younger and not as mature.
So let's talk about that online class a little more. We've been offering online courses here since 97, and our students have grown to like them, but they also covet them because it gives them a lot more flexibility in developing their work schedules. I remember in the old days when, you know, if class was at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, believe it or not, we actually had classes that late in the day. Well, that was just your problem, not ours, and you had to figure it out with your employer. But, you know, things seem so much more streamlined these days to accommodate these students who can maybe come to campus for a few hours a day, or maybe not at all, and then do the rest online. And then it gives them lots of wiggle room, I guess, for being able to get a 6-hour shift or whatever, you know, with their job. So they can pay the bills and buy food and important stuff like this. We didn't have that choice back in the early 80s and even late 70s when I was in college. We just had to take what they offered. What are your thoughts on this major paradigm shift in higher ed?
I think it is great, especially for graduate level classes, but even for undergraduate, it gives the opportunity for people that otherwise wouldn't have access to higher education. And I think WT's done an excellent job rolling this out. I have a son that's an aerospace engineer, and he actually completed his MBA through WT online. And he did it online, and I think he was very successful at it. So I think it just provides more opportunity. Like you said, when I was going to school, undergrad, of course, you went to class. There wasn't any online. And then when I went to graduate school, it was all in the classroom, and you had to drive down here at night. It was night school because I was working. And then you'd have to really jockey hard on your schedule. I mean, your class schedules, because they're not offered every semester. So I think it just provides more flexibility and opportunity, like you talked about.
Given that you have a career's worth of experience, do you teach straight from the text, or do you tell stories that illustrate the textbook concepts?
You know, I talk about the textbook concepts, and I use, you know, the publisher's materials, but then I'm able to explain how I've seen this. And basically for almost everything I can think of information or examples that I've seen of good managers, bad managers. It's just like having a good coach, a bad coach. And you've got good employees, you've got bad employees. And I explained to them that actually managing people is probably one of the harder things that you have to do because everybody is different. And that's really hard for, because I was, XL Energy and SBS is largely an engineering focused business, very, very highly technical, and dealt with lots of engineering managers, and their skill set was not managing people, getting work done through people.
There's a certain benefit to reaching an older age here because, you know, after a life lived well and a career well spent, you got stories, right? You find yourself becoming a storyteller more and more, not just in the classroom necessarily, but I think just in regular life. I know I do.
Yes. Yeah, I think of one of my greatest mentors, Jerry Diller, who's been passed away, but he's the one that actually hired me. He would have all kinds of stories to tell us, and we would listen to his stories probably about 5 or 6 times. And I still love this individual because he was my mentor. But it's just having that experience and being able to relate to the subject that you're teaching to students that really have a hard time relating what you're talking about.
Well, that is the downside of getting old. You forget how many times you've told that story, right?
Yeah, exactly.
How have your students received you?
I think pretty good. You know, sometimes I wonder, like in class today, you know, they don't contribute a lot. And sometimes you wonder how closely they're paying attention. Is it interesting? What can I do to make it a little bit more interesting for them? Maybe I'm going into some subjects a little bit deeper than I should, since it is a principles or introduction type class.
You also serve on Dr. Abdelat's advisory board for the College of Business. What role do you play there, and what kinds of things do you do as an advisory board?
Well, the advisory board meets twice a year, and we basically talk more on the strategic side for the college, looking at their strategic business plan, also talking about what is the status of the university, what is the competition. You know, now after the pandemic, a lot of other universities have ramped up their online offerings. And so now WT is facing a lot of competition where they had a really great dominance in that area. And so, so that we talk about all of those things, but we're able to offer the dean our thoughts where they should emphasize things from and it's more of a, you know, a business advisory group where we're just providing some of our thoughts from the business angle of people hiring WT graduates.
What's the value of the College of Business to our community?
You know, WT is a phenomenal regional university. And at XL, we were always looking for employees, and we would have to go sometimes out of region to hire people. And what we found out inevitably is the people would come, they would get some experience, and then they would leave and go back to their home areas. So we really focused on developing, hiring, and training employees that are from our region. And WT allows us to do that.
After the break, we'll take a look at the future of energy production in the Panhandle and beyond.
There's a reason why our programs are rated so highly by independent reviewers. We are committed to continuously improving what we do. Whether it is in the classroom or online, the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business strives to stay ahead of the curve, not behind it. Join us in the classroom or online and see the difference. We're WCSB accredited and among the most elite business schools around the world. Reach for the stars and do it with a WT business degree in hand. For more info, find us online at wtamu.edu/COB or call 806-651-2525. From the Texas Panhandle to the world, we are here to help you reach for those stars.
When I moved here in 1989, the only wind turbines were the kinds farmers and ranchers had to draw water for their stock. I have one of those air motor windmills in my front yard, used only to water trees. But about 20 years ago, wind farms started appearing both in the Panhandle and the entire West Texas region, like down near Abilene and Big Spring. Today, there are 11,000 wind turbines in the Panhandle. That's the top 26 counties of Texas alone. You can almost drive across the entirety of the Panhandle at night on I-40 and never be unable to see a blinking red light atop one of them somewhere. Naturally, there's a, you know, a love-hate relationship with them. Some people hate them, claiming they ruin the landscape, kill too many birds, that the blades eventually have to be retired because of wear and age, which creates new problems. Others say that we're harvesting the most abundant natural resource we have out here. Amarillo is the windiest major city in the U.S., and a dead calm day? That's a rarity, and it puts people in a strange mood, wondering what's missing, what's wrong with this picture. In the middle of this is SPS. As I said earlier, I don't see those coal trains from Wyoming like I once did. How is power generation changing in the Panhandle, and what percent is coming from renewables these days?
You know, as I mentioned earlier, wind energy is quickly moving up to be one of the top energy resources for the Xcel Energy SPS system. In 2023, it made up 35% of our annual energy production, which is phenomenal. Natural gas being 41%. I think we're going to continue to see more and more wind generation in the area, and we'll probably be seeing some of the wind farms being replaced. It's hard to believe, like, one of the very first wind farms that was built to serve our customers was just outside of White Deer. That contract ended probably over 10 years ago. Right now, it's probably just dumping energy into the hourly energy market and getting compensated that way. And we're going to see more and more contracts expire and new wind facilities being built that are going to be even taller, more efficient in harvesting the wind power out of the wind. And plus, they'll be able to capture more tax credits from the federal government. That's really one of the biggest drivers for wind energy and even solar energy is the substantial tax credits that are available to that. So I think we're going to see both of those. But at the same time, they're intermittent resources, meaning it depends on whether the wind's blowing. Like yesterday, there was not much wind. In the morning time, sometimes there's not much wind. But at other times, especially in the spring and the fall, when the loads are down, the temperatures are more in that in-between air conditioning and heating. It's just in that dead zone. There's not much electric load. And so we'll see more wind energy than all of our load. And so we end up transporting wind energy out of the area. The real-time price for energy will go negative, basically telling wind farms, hey, if you're dumping energy onto us, we don't need it. And you're going to have to pay us for us to take it. Now, because of the tax credits, they may still do that because they're going to still get tax credits. So it's very complicated economic, but very fascinating.
Yeah, those numbers you gave her, those are averages. But yeah, if you have a day like today, we're recording this on the 24th of October. It's supposed to be 90 degrees and the wind's howling. So I imagine those turbines are really cranking out some electricity.
Yeah, they're probably at full output. And you start getting up above 50 miles an hour, they'll start cutting out because the wind is just too strong. And we've seen cutouts before. It's amazing how little wind it needs to start producing.
Now, no energy source is perfect. Doesn't matter what the fuel is, whether it's coal or natural gas, or whether it's wind or solar or hydro or even nuclear, I guess. What are the limitations of wind energy, which seems to be the focal point of renewables out here?
Yeah, there's two major points about wind and solar, and they're both intermittent resources, meaning it's not like you can just push a button and you're going to get it. The wind has to be blowing or the sun has to be shining, right? And so that's why it's intermittent. The other thing is they're what's called inverter-based, and they basically use computers to replicate the perfect 60 hertz sine signal. You know, people don't realize it, but the electrons go back and forth 60 times a second in the power lines. And so they're using a computer that takes a signal from the system and then replicates that. And so if they start getting if you get too much wind or too much solar or too much inverter-based generation, it can start distorting that 60 hertz perfect sine wave. And all your computers, everything require that perfect 60 hertz sine wave. So you're still going to need what's called rotating mass on the system, which are the magnets in a generator passing by the wire exactly 3,600 times per second to create the 60 hertz. So you're going to still need natural gas to do that. So I think we're going to continue to see increased renewables, but the whole concept thinking there's going to be 100% renewables is a fantasy. It's just not technically possible.
Now, what about solar? I mean, I've started seeing a few solar farms out in close to this area. I know of one not far from Childress, and I've certainly seen a bunch in North Florida along I-10. I think a lot of this happened after the Inflation Reduction Act was passed. Is there a future for solar in this region? I mean, Amarillo gets 73% of available sunlight all year. I mean, we're tied for 16th most in the U.S.
Well, what's interesting about solar is it sort of naturally follows the peak energy curve throughout a day. So usually, like SPS, our peak electricity usage in a day would be between 4 and 5 p.m. each day. Well, that's when the sun is going to be the most intense during the summer. So you can sort of, it is a little bit more reliable than wind energy from day to day. So you're going to see more and more use of solar. It gets down to economics, and we've been a lower cost economic, and our natural gas is so cheap here that it makes it a little bit harder for solar to compete, and it relies on the federal subsidies. But the one you see in Childress is actually connected to the downstate ERCOT grid, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, where they have a little bit higher, marginal cost and hourly cost. And then the same is the case for Florida, where they don't have as much natural gas generation.
Now, there's delicious irony in the fact that Texas, you know, a state that is steeped in oil, is also the biggest producer of wind energy, nearly three times as much as the second place state, which is Iowa. How do you explain this anomaly?
It comes down to pure economics. You know, the dollar on the desk or the dollar on the table, where with the tax credits, it can be very favorable compared to other sources of energy. And we're talking about pure energy, not capacity. So, basically, even the oil companies realize if the federal government's going to give that much tax credits to wind energy, we should be using it. It's more favorable than using natural gas.
The juxtaposition is perhaps no more visually stunning than to go down just south of Big Spring on Highway 87, and you're in the middle of the oil field, and you see that they've leased land for wind turbines, and they're standing there shoulder to shoulder, if you will, both extracting energy out of nature, one from beneath the ground and the other above.
That's right. I mean, when you think about electricity, it's basically all you're doing is converting one energy form to another one. You're not making energy. You're just converting it. You're making electricity by using another energy resource.
And what about hydroelectric or nuclear? We don't hear much about those out here in Amarillo.
No. Actually, probably in the early 80s, SPS was looking at nuclear. But then you had Three Mile Island and everything else sort of detract nationally. And then you had Fukushima. You had Chernobyl. You have all these events. I don't think you're going to see much large-scale nuclear. The big push now is going to be small modular unit nuclear, which are going to be smaller, basically factory-made nuclear units, and they'll probably be put into the ground, you know, under, you know, so, and so It won't cost as much. You can get the economies of scale by building a bunch of these, but they're going to be smaller. You know, I think that's the future. There's been talk about using hydrogen because it's clean burning in the long term, and converting wind energy and storing it as hydrogen and then burning the hydrogen when the peak demand is at the highest. There's all of those, but they're very expensive, you know. And then there's always the whole, well, let's just build batteries. Well, batteries don't make energy. They just store it, and they're not extremely efficient at doing that, and they're very costly, capital intensive.
Now, I've heard many concerns about EVs and how much extra electricity we would need, but probably even more importantly than being able to keep EVs going is our need for electricity to power data centers and AI facilities. Artificial intelligence is a major consumer of electricity, and it will place huge demands on power generation. In fact, Microsoft just made a deal to restart Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania. That was the place that had, you know, that partial meltdown back in 1979. Microsoft wants to use its power generating capabilities to, well, to be used for AI, which is something that never even factored into conversations even just a couple years ago. How are we going to have enough electricity for all this?
Well, that is a big issue. There is a huge amount of growth in the demand for electricity. And chunks of it are coming for this region out of the Permian Basin because of all the growth. It takes electricity to basically pull that all that liquid out of the ground. Then you are seeing a lot of data centers. You know, Google built one of their wind farms just south of Hereford in Castro County. They have one of the wind farms that's connected to our system. And basically, a lot of these companies have sustainability goals where they want all of their electricity to be carbon free or something like that. It's basically an accounting game where they're producing the energy, just selling it into the market, and then saying that energy is off credit, off washing what they use somewhere else. But you know, you go somewhere like a tourist and you take a picture with your phone. That picture is automatically getting uploaded into the cloud. And what's the cloud? It's a bunch of data centers all around the world. And then you start looking around and you look at everybody that's taking a picture. You're thinking, holy cow, there's a data center being used up right today from everybody taking pictures at this tourist spot. You know, so a lot of it's just huge amounts of data that's going, and you just don't know how long it's going to be stored. And it's just a big business because people are willing to pay for that. They want that convenience. And more and more information is being stored in the cloud. And then, like you said, you've got artificial intelligence. You've got cryptocurrency is a huge one where everybody's trying to mine for Bitcoin. They're building data centers. And I always got very nervous about that. You know, it's like, well, that's fly by night, you know, here today, gone tomorrow. We're not going to go build a substation for somebody unless they pay the full freight for it.
My guest today has been David Hudson, part-time instructor in the College of Business and retired president of Southwestern Public Service. David, walk us out the door here. What do you think the future energy landscape is going to look like?
Well, you know, I think we will see increased usage of wind energy in the short term. In the longer term, I think we're going to start moving towards small modular unit nuclear. We're probably talking 10 years out. Coal is going to be gone just because of its carbon intensity and then also its other emissions that it has. The other thing about fossil generation, it uses water to cool the steam cycle for the most part, unless you're just using a jet engine, basically, that's pushing a drive. So you're going to still see some of that. You're going to see newer generations of gas generation that are more efficient. You're going to see increased uses of solar. As solar costs come down with more production of solar. But I think you'll probably maybe even see some use of hydrogen, you know, converting HTO, HTO water into hydrogen and oxygen, and then combusting that again to make electricity. So, you know, it's hard to imagine. I can remember in the 80s, we would laugh about wind generation saying its costs are too phenomenal. But now here it is. It's going to be one of the most prevalent sources of electricity for our region and the nation.
You've been listening to Buff Speak from the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University. Our executive producer is Justin Lovell, and Allison Hunter is our associate producer. Our co-editors are Maverick Evans and Paul Torres. Lindsay Bjork is our director of marketing and outreach initiatives, which includes overseeing Buff Speak. Dr. Jeffrey Babb is director of accreditation and is our technical consultant. Finally, Dr. Amjad Abdulat is dean of the college. You can find us online at wtamu.edu/COB for more information about our programs. Be sure to check out our many academic offerings. Come for the quality, stay for the small classes, affordable tuition, and friendly, approachable professors. And look online at our faculty blog, profspeak.com, for more insights. You can listen to Buff Speak on your favorite podcast portal, as well as on our website, buffspeak.biz. And if you like what you've been hearing, don't be afraid to share us with your friends, colleagues, and family. Word of mouth has always been the best form of advertising. Until next time, love one another. For the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University, I am Dr. Nick Gerlich. And as always, go Buffs! Buff Speak.